This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in an increasingly connected, always-on world. You can see evidence of it everywhere you go. In a restaurant, we no longer talk with our dining companions. We're glued to our phones. Walking down the street, we stay glued to our screens. We just can't seem to avert our gaze from glowing screens of all shapes and sizes as we keep up with the world that swirls around us. We're checking email or our Twitter feeds, our Facebook updates, and with what's new on Instagram and any other of the myriad digital distractions out there. And yes, I said distractions. True, this connected like never before universe is informative and entertaining, but all this connectedness has resulted in many of us being disconnected from life. We just can't help ourselves. We've become addicted to our digital lives. This isn't healthy. These digital preoccupations are changing us. They're changing how we think, how we behave. And if this describes you or someone you love, stay with us. We'll tell you how to unplug so you can reconnect. We'll help you become digitally detoxed. Levi Felix is founder and CEO of California-based Digital Detox, which was founded in 2012. They operate something unthinkable to many, technology-free retreats, and they promote more mindful use of technology. Levi Felix joins us this morning by phone from New York. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
You're welcome. And with us in our Spirit Square studio is Matt Crossman. He's a freelance writer who last July decided to take a one-month break from social media. He wrote about that experience and the realizations that he came to about his relationship to his digital relationships in Charlotte Magazine in November. He also has written for Our State, Rolling Stone, and NASCAR Illustrated, among other publications. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
You're welcome. I just described what I've seen, anecdotally. In places like restaurants, I've seen the same thing in movie theaters, very disturbingly, during the movie. I've seen people texting and checking in on their phones while driving cars. There have been reports of serious accidents of pedestrians walking into things, walking into traffic, falling into fountains because they're checking their phones as they walk down the street. Just how serious has all of this become? Let me ask Levi Felix first. How serious do you see this problem?
Well, I mean, it's a great question because it's the first time in human history that, you know, an entire civilization is connected to each other by a simple, you know, yet quite complex device that's in their hand. And because of this, you know, at any moment we can be everywhere. So, you know, we're sitting with our family and all of a sudden we're across the world, you know, watching a video, you know, about cats, or walking down the street and all of a sudden we're transported somewhere totally different. And we're seeing the impact. You know, 50% of accidents are caused by someone being on their device. You know, it takes almost twice as long to cross the street when you're looking at the phone. I bring those up because you mentioned that as an example. And I think it's important to not jump to the conclusion and say, you know, things are bad. But I think it's important to say, how did we get here so quickly and where do we want to go from here? Because, you know, we're innovating technology so quickly that in 2-3 years from now, we're going to be at a place where we can't come back.
So would you call this, if it's not bad, would you call it an addiction? And if it's an addiction, isn't that intrinsically bad?
Well, so I guess the important thing to ask now, which is it's amazing that you're asking, is this an addiction? You know, currently it's not diagnosed as an addiction. However, you know, I'm with you. I would argue that it's an addiction, and because, you know, the negative habits that are forming are harming people in our society. And the argument ones would say is that well, you know, for some it's an addiction, and for some it's just bad habit. Unfortunately, it's a bad habit until something awful happens to you. So I think we're at the crossroads now where people are finally realizing that, oh yeah, you know, young girls spending time on Instagram, you know, that affects the way they perceive themselves, that affects the way that they're going to develop, and that affects how they share themselves with the world. And, you know, getting underneath it, maybe it's time we ask the people who are developing the technologies and who have the data around these technologies to help us look at that, understand, okay, what are the real negative, you know, implications, and how can we can we change the way we design these technologies?
I think there's also a connection with the word desire here. I'm not sure why I think that, but I read some stories of participants in your camps where you digitally detox them for days on end. They're not allowed to have watches or phones or even go by their own names. We'll talk about that. But some of these people talk about feeling phantom vibrations in the leg where they normally carry their phone in their pants pocket. And I have experienced this, where I feel the phone vibrating because that's where I keep it, but the phone's not in that pocket because I've put it on the dresser because it's a Saturday and I don't need to carry it around all day. Have you experienced this, Matt?
I haven't had the phantom vibration, but I did notice with either the vibrations or the announcements, you know, you read about that there's basically a dopamine effect in your brain that you hear that and you get so excited about whatever it is that you have to go check it. I shut off the notifications on my phone, so it makes a noise only when I get a text. I don't have it set up to do that for email or Facebook or Twitter. And it's mostly because it's so distracting. Like if you're eating dinner and it beeps, all you can think about is that beep until you go check it. I mean, it's Pavlovian. And, yeah. You know, you mentioned people, you know, looking at their phone when they are driving in. I noticed a person behind me today had her phone in her left hand and her right hand on the steering wheel, and I could see her eyes that she was – we're on 77 driving in the middle of rush hour traffic. I'm like, I want to get out from in front of this lady because she's going to end up hitting me because whatever she's doing on the phone is more important than driving. And that's – you know, that happens 1,000 times a day.
Yeah. The thirst for knowledge used to be considered a good thing. If you were going to go to the library or read a book or look something up in the dictionary or the encyclopedia, that was a good thing. And I guess it can be argued in this 21st century world that being always connected, being a nanosecond away from saying, okay, Google, tell me this – is part of that search for knowledge, and it gives us a never-ending stream of access to it.
But it's a never-ending stream of access to junk. On my Facebook page all week was the fact that a cat that looks like Kylo Ren from Star Wars is trending. I'm sorry, I don't care. Well, frankly, I do kind of want to see a cat that looks like Kylo Ren. What does that say about me? And I never clicked on it just so I could say that I didn't click on it. But there is – it's if it was a search for relevant knowledge and if Twitter and Facebook were presenting to us information we can actually use and digest and that would make us understand the world better, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But it's 90% pictures of grotesquely ugly cats.
Is this an example of just existential boredom? We're all just so bored and with life as we see it around us that we're searching for something, anything – that will lift us out of that. And this phone, this screen, these pads, computers will take us there?
Yeah, I got frustrated about a year or a year and a half ago. And this is going to sound vain, but I'll say it anyway. There was a series of stories that I had worked very hard on, poured my heart and soul into it, put it up on Twitter, and you know, it was crickets. The reaction that I wanted, and again, you know, that's vanity speaking. I wanted people to tell me on Twitter that they like this story. Nobody says anything. So I started consciously doing power rankings, which is like the internet meme of the ages, the dumbest possible things I could think of just as sort of as satire. And it turned out that people liked it and encouraged me to keep doing it. I'm like, you guys are – I don't know if you're missing the point or making my point that you're liking the thing that I'm doing that's intentionally stupid.
Now, Levi, you want to chime in on that before I ask you the next question? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important thing not to get judgmental about what people are consuming. You know, I think that's people have always been consuming things that some would find fascinating, interesting, others would find as a waste of time. I think the problem is we don't know how to be bored anymore. We don't know how to fill the space because we're moving so quickly, and we've become addicted to that constant connection, that constant information, so to speak. I think simultaneously, you know, when we're on the screen, you know, it could really be anything. It's just that dopamine and that oxytocin flush that we're getting, that our body and our brains are now, you know, reappropriating that to the device. We don't really realize, you know, it's the cat. We don't really realize, you know, it's the new video that's gone viral for 20 seconds. We're just looking for that next push. And because of that, and we don't realize, we just keep going back to the phone over and over again. And all we want is connection in the world. All we want is community and culture. All we want is family and things that make us feel loved and celebrated. And because we're getting less of that from the people in our family, from social groups, we're going online.
But aren't we getting less and less of that because we don't talk to each other because we're buried in our phones?
And exactly, that's the negative cycle. You know, as Sherry Turkle from MIT, from Alone Together and the Importance of Conversation, and other folks who've now recently come out with books that it's quite silly that are saying it's important to talk. You know, that's the irony of the time. It's kind of like the movie Idiocracy, when we now have self-help books and even retreats like we do that have to get people off their phones. And so that's the scary thing now that there's, now that there has to be experts that say, oh no, this is looking like it's going down the wrong way. And it's, you know, in the end, the most important thing is children, and it's affecting their developmental states. It's affecting the way that they're creating their relationships. And what does it look like in 10 to 20 years when we're living in a world that's defined by that?
Well, let me ask you about that, because we've been worried about a lot of things over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st century, things that we were worried about intensely, and we've just kind of let it slide by the wayside and forgotten about, and it turned out maybe the worry was a waste of time. Is this one of those situations where this too shall pass?
Well, I was in a discussion the other day, and someone said, well, we were all worried about TV, and it turned out fine. And then they looked down at their phone, and I said, well, it's just in your hand now. It's just changed. The medium has changed. And I like to bring up Marshall McLuhan and say, the medium is the message. So when it was in a TV and it was on the wall, at least you could shut it off. But now it's in our hands, and soon it'll be in a contact lens, and then it'll soon be connected to a small nano chip in the back of our brain. And the more the friction, when the friction becomes less, meaning getting on a device, getting on a screen, getting information, getting data, having someone connect to you. Imagine when the push notification is no longer in your hand, but is really, you know, connected to your brain, and your work says it has to be on between 9 and 5. Well, when that friction disappears, that's scary. And so someone might say in 10 years, oh, remember when we were so concerned about screens in our hands? Oh, well, we made it through that. You know, and then all of a sudden the person looks in their top left corner of their eye and they're watching something come into their feed and their contact lens. And that might sound crazy, but it's not. I mean, it's happening. There's, you know, AI and is coming through, virtual reality, the headsets, Oculus Rift, all that is coming spring, which is amazing and fantastic, and the innovation is incredible. And, you know, there's no one asking, is this ethical? No one's asking, at what age could you start using this? And there's no FDA of technology. There's no board saying, oh, you know, this isn't ready for public, or oh, this, you know, this could be bad for you know, child development, or et cetera.
And this is coming from a man, Levi Felix, who spent his earlier in his life as an executive with a technology startup in L.A. You were one of the people that we were talking about who are developing these products that we're now addicted to. Your life must have been – you walked away from that for, 2 years, I think. And we only have 30 seconds here, but what was your life like back then that made you walk away from it?
Well, in short, I had, you know, two phones, 2007, 2009. Those years I became fully on it. Multiple phones. I slept with my devices. I had my computer on all the time. I was sleeping at the office, working 75 hours a week, and I loved it. And it was incredible. I was all exploring all the future opportunities with technology, and then I burned out. I ended up in the hospital with internal bleeding, and it's when I got out of that hospital that I realized, you know, if I can't be right here, right now, if I'm everywhere else, then how can I be me?
We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Chesterbrook Academy, whose mission is to prepare children academically, socially, and emotionally for elementary school, hosting an open house on Saturday. Details at chesterbrookacademy.com. And Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet patients a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. We're going to hear from an award-winning journalist and historian who has interviewed some of the world's key leaders about his new novel that contains at its center a little-known historical fact about African-American colleges in the 1940s. That's tomorrow at 9, and then we're going to meet the director, the artistic director, of the storied Dance Theater of Harlem. They're in town to perform. There's also an exhibition about the company opening at the Harvey B. Dance Center. We'll hear about both on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, tens of thousands of Americans are dying each year from overdoses from prescription painkillers and heroin. Presidential candidates from both parties have pledged to better address the country's growing addiction crisis. New local, state, and federal efforts to stem the epidemic.
Join the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about digitally detoxing. Have you ever deliberately turned off your connection to the digital world for even a week, even a day, even an hour? Have you done it? What was the reaction of your friends and family to not being available on cell phones or Facebook or Twitter or whatever? What was your personal reaction? Did it feel like withdrawal to you? You can email us or you can get to us through your digital devices at WFAE.
Please tweet us about the time you quit tweeting.
Yes, please do that. Matt Crossman is in our studio. He's a freelance writer who wrote an article called My Month Off, Social Media for Charlotte Magazine. It appeared in the November issue. And Levi Felix is the founder and CEO of a company called Digital Detox. He helps people do just this. We've been talking about this being having addictive properties. We're unable to. There's a release of dopamine when we get a ping from our cell phone and we check it. We feel good about ourselves. We have a desire to be in touch. We feel connected. So there's an addictive quality to this. But other people are now reporting that this constant need to check email and get these push feeds of news updates and have to check them from Facebook and Twitter and other things have become a genuine burden. Have you found that to be the case, Matt?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's – yeah, certainly in my life there is. Checking Twitter to see what the news is, checking Facebook to see, you know, how funny people think that the latest thing that I posted about my kids is. Yeah, it's kind of shameful. I feel like a dork when I do it. You know,
really?
Checking these as if that bears some as if that carries some weight in what my own self-perception of my own self-image is, you know, that I'm getting – you know, worth from people who I don't know liking this story or liking this comment or liking this photo. But that's what it's there for. I mean, that's why the like button exists, is to make you feel good about yourself. And it's really sad. And I mean, I'm speaking of myself specifically, how sad that is.
Did you know this before you took that month off? And did you take that month off voluntarily, or did you take it off because somebody at Charlotte Magazine, the editor, said, we want to explore this, and we want you to be the one that explores it, so take a month off and see what it feels like?
It was a combination of those things. I was pretty fed up with, you know, my own use of social media and trying to figure out ways to curb that. And my aha moment was, across my Twitter feed, there was a great debate about the merits of chastity, where a person who I follow, who I otherwise admire, was eviscerating a professional athlete who had taken a vow of chastity before he married his girlfriend. Uh-huh. And this Twitter person condemned the player for that. And I'm like, I don't need to be reading that. I don't need to be listening to arguments about whether chastity is good or not. Obviously, it's good. If that person decides he wants to live a chaste life, good for him. And so a couple days later, I was having lunch with the editor of Charlotte Magazine. We sort of discussed that and the vanity that involved with writing and tweeting and Facebooking. And, you know, that frankly, the most important part of my decision to spend a month off of social media is when somebody agreed to pay me to do it. And I'm not going to lie. And I had an added bonus that for part of the month, I happened to be in the Rocky Mountains where I didn't have internet access anyway. So that made it, quote unquote, easier. But frankly, it was actually the hardest part was the habit. You know what I mean? Like you go to your, you point your browser to, you know, you start typing in FA and it just fills in Facebook for you. You type in TW, it fills in Twitter for you. There was a couple times where I did that out of just dumb habit. But other than that, frankly, it really wasn't all that hard.
And Levi, you said that you kind of stepped away from this because it made you were involved in a 90-hour-a-week job where you had two cell phones and computers going 24/7, and you were always having to check, et cetera, et cetera. And you got sick, so you walked away for 2 years. And you come from a technology background, so can you disconnect without being seen by others as a Luddite?
Well, I definitely have been called a Luddite a number of times. You know, I'm not. I had to walk away. There's a point when you realize that you're not really living. And yeah, my fiance and I went and traveled for, you know, almost 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
And we were on and off, you know, our screens and devices. But there became a point when we ended up living on an island in Cambodia for, it was over 6 months, and, you know, rainwater was used for drinking water, and fish that we spearfished, that's what we ate for dinner, and we built all our own bungalows, and all of a sudden you didn't know if it was Monday or Thursday, and your day was just filled with real life. You know, there was you forgot, and you lost your shoes, and it didn't matter, and it was like in the movies when Leonardo DiCaprio disappears, or when these people disappear somewhere, and they come back, and they're changed. You know, their perspectives change. Everything is different. And that's what I've noticed. Living on this island, realizing that this is life, eating fresh food, eating fresh fish, swimming, and waking up in the morning and not knowing if it's 5 or if it's 8, but because the chickens woke you up. And that's when we had our real aha moment, was being away from it all and saying, you know, questioning why are we even living? If we catalog our entire lives, if we're taking photos of everything that we're doing, if we're constantly checking in, if we meet every person that we meet becomes a friend on Facebook, but we don't even keep in touch with them, we just see what they're doing passively, what's it all for? And so when we got back from this travel, it hit us in the face that everyone was always on their screens, and we couldn't go anywhere without was really, to be honest, being a little depressed and wanting to run away.
And in fact, you wrote that before you went away, it hadn't gotten to be that bad because smartphones were just beginning to make inroads when you went away. When you came back, they had already taken over the world, and the change was dramatic, to say the least. You took it to the extreme, because I don't know very many people who can take 3 years off and go live on an exotic island. But when you disconnect, even if it's for a weekend, and the both of you have disconnected, in the moment, not now, but in the moment, what did you miss the most?
Well, for me, I mean, what I missed, to be honest, what I missed the most when I was disconnected was checking in with my closest friends and family. And that, I mean, that was it. But nothing else. I didn't miss any videos. I don't miss any Facebook. I don't miss any social media. I definitely don't miss my email.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what I miss is being able to share the moment with my family in some capacity. But you can't do that with a screen anyway.
Yeah, I didn't miss anything. I mean, I wasn't on an exotic island in Cambodia. I just lived my normal life in Charlotte. I missed literally zero.
So when you when you get away from it, when you walk, whether it's for the month that you did or the 3 years that you did, and these sessions that you do with people who come to your digital detox sessions. When they walk away and they think about it, is there anything to regret? Do they find out that life is better, fuller, richer without this in their hand?
Oh, I hope so. It would make me really sad if somebody walked away and said, oh, boy, there was that cat of Kylo Ren and I never got to saw it, and now my life is empty and vapid.
It'll be on ABC News tonight.
Yeah, that would make me even sadder.
Levi?
Yeah, I think people walk away, and this might sound like an exaggeration, but they're almost like new people. We have people, whether they work at Google or whether it's a single mom or whether it's a college student, they walk away and you can see it. They're standing up straighter. They're looking people in the eyes. They tell me, I got the best sleep I've had in my adult life. And we say, well, why is that? And some people say, I feel, you know, less stressed. I feel less anxious. In short, though, the biggest answer is I left offline for a few days, and I go back, and it's all still happening, and I didn't miss anything. And that's one of the biggest wake-up calls that people realize the world's going to keep spinning, and they don't have to watch the feed. It'll just keep going. In fact, it's better if they don't watch the feed.
Yeah, I felt like I felt or I thought more clearly by the end of the month, because you are just bombarded with so much information garbage that it conflicts with your ability to think clearly. And it made me think, I took a class in college in 1992, I think it was, that was called Information Anxiety. And it was a study of all of the different ways you could collect information then and how vastly different it was from the whole course of humanity. And this was in 1992, before the internet, before email. CNN existed, but Fox didn't, and MSNBC didn't. And the amount of information now available versus 1992, when we thought we had too much information, it's increased a thousandfold.
Because we can't analyze it. We can't digest it. And part of the problem, I think, with American politics today is that we're being bombarded from all sides all the time, and everything's a crisis, and everything has to be solved right now. There's no time to think. And if you could think, you wouldn't be thinking, because you'd be distracted by the cat on Facebook or the next thing that comes in your news feed about another candidate. You can't sit back and let it percolate. No, there's no time for that.
There's no time for, carefully thinking about something, because careful thought is something you used to do. Careful thought is something your grandparents did. We don't have time for careful thought.
You say, Levi, that we have reached this society has reached so many tipping points, climate change tipping points, etc. But you say that we have reached a tipping point, recognizing that we don't know how to interact with other people in real life. Now, parents, I think, have noticed this with their kids, and there is a commercial on television now, I think, for a telephone company. Where a father is sitting on a sofa with two girls on either side of him. We presume they're his daughters. And they're sitting there with their phones, and their little thumbs are going like crazy. And he says, "Are you texting each other?" And they are, because they'd rather have the conversation. I guess it avoids the adult, but they'd rather have the conversation in a text than using their voices. Have you noticed that with adults, Levi, in your sessions?
When I was in Cambodia, the phone was introduced, to this island, to this family. And there was actually two girls, two sisters who were probably in their late 20s, early 30s, who would text and call each other from down the beach. And so I think it's important to say that introducing new technologies, just like, let's say, introducing new chocolate. So a new company comes out, and we've never had chocolate like this before. And this new company comes out, and they launch a chocolate, and they have so much money to meet us everywhere we are. Every street corner, there's a sign for this chocolate. Every bus stop, there's a sign for this chocolate. And everyone's eating it because they give it out for free. Well, as they make this chocolate better and better, you're going to want to try each new development of the chocolate. And that's kind of where I look at the phone. It's just like the food industry. And look at where we are with the food industry. What are they serving children in schools? It's hard to get good food. Whether it's urban deserts and urban food deserts, and with just like food, chocolate, a really delicious thing, we're not questioning, whether or not it's good for us. We're not even questioning whether or not we like it. It's convenient, and so all of a sudden we do it more. So for kids passing emojis back and forth, that's just the modern day notepad, so dad can't see it. But that being said, as we grow up and we develop, we realize it's not, we don't like it.
Except I do know adults who would much prefer to text or send an email than make a phone call, because a phone call requires a commitment and requires a two-way street conversation, whereas with a phone call, with a text or an email, you can just zap off a sentence and you're done with it.
Yeah, I'm certainly in that camp. My kids constantly, "Can you text Ella's daddy and see if we can meet them at the park?" "No, don't text him. Call him." And I argue with my 9-year-old daughter about whether I should text or call her friend's parents, because you're right. I want to text them and say, "Hey, can you meet us at the park?" Because that takes 5 seconds.
We talk about our digital lives as though they were completely and totally separate from real life. They've become real part of our real lives, haven't they?
Depends on what you mean by real. Most people's pages are not real. They're the best version of themselves that they want to put forward so other people can think better of them, as opposed to what the actual truth is.
And we've done a show on that, particularly with regard to young people who don't understand that when their friends are talking about themselves and their lives and their experiences on Facebook, they leave out all the bad parts. Okay. And so it's leaving people, young people, and I guess some adults as well, maybe you can chime in on this, Levi, with this feeling of depression because they feel that their lives don't match up with what they're seeing their friends living on Facebook.
Studies show that active internet users are 2.5 times more likely to be depressed than those who just use it sometimes. And what are we putting out there in the world? Only our highlight reel, only our front stage. You know, if life is a performance, we're only putting out, you know, what we want to be in the bright lights. Everything else is hidden. So we're comparing our backstage, all of the things we've messed up on, with everyone else's, you know, yeah, front stage, and that's depressing. When you sit at home and you just see what everyone else is doing, that's amazing. You're not seeing the 500 photos they're not sharing of their day. You're only seeing the best. And when you compare that to what you've been up to, of course you're going to sit there and say, oh, my life isn't as good.
Yeah. Matt, you wondered about what people were missing with each other by only posting the best days and the biggest wins of their life and the best pictures of their life. Did you discover anything once you unplugged for that month?
Well, yeah, just that. Just how much, you know, how much we're shaped more by the struggles that we've had in our lives, whether we succeed over them or are overcome by them. I mean, I'm sure the biggest event in Levi's life was going to the hospital and then realizing what had happened to his life. And I doubt, Levi, maybe you did post that you were in the hospital at that time, but you if you did, it was probably not in the exact context. But that's a much more real connection to say, man, my life is all I made a joke in my story that my next social media piece would be to post only unflattering things about myself and to see what would happen. And if there's an editor out there who is listening, who has a paycheck that they would like to give me for that, I would be happy to do that. I'd be curious to see what my Twitter feed and my Facebook friends, what that count would be at the end.
Yeah, if you're a Debbie Downer on Facebook or Twitter, is anybody going to follow you? Would they find it humorous? Would they be coming to your rescue? Would they want to rescue you? Or would they just defriend you?
I think that's a great question. Early on in fate, I have three brothers back in Michigan, and we all look very much alike. And I have the suspicion that some of my brother's high school friends think I'm my brother. And so early on in Facebook, I would friend these people who I wasn't 100% sure who they were. And this one woman was just unloading this unbelievably tragic story. And I finally, I didn't even know who she was. And I found myself following this and feeling for her and, you know, feeling empathy for her. But then I finally had to say, I don't even know who this person is. And I think I ended up unfriending her because it was in my feed the whole time.
Matt Mark in Charlotte has written while we've been talking, I've noticed over the past 5 years that whenever I'm with many of my friends, if there's more than 30 seconds of silence, the phones come out and Facebook browsing begins. This is true.
Oh, yeah.
It impacts legitimate conversation because you can't even stop to think and ponder an answer before people's attention is distracted. Desiree on Facebook says, I love my screen-free Sundays wherein I digitally detox once a week. It's good stuff. And I owe my sanity to it. Now, a couple of years ago, Levi Felix founded this company called Digital Detox, where he helps people get rid of their phones and their addictions to their constant attention to these digital platforms. And when we come back, we'll talk about exactly how that idea originated, what goes on in these sessions, who partakes, and what the ultimate result of all of it is. Is it only from the moment that they're in those camps that they can digitally detox and they go right back to it when they get out? Or does it have a lasting effect? We'll find out. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura. Test drives available and new 2016 inventory now arriving daily for winter, including available super handling all-wheel drive models. More at HendrickAcura.com. Tens of thousands of Americans are dying each year from overdoses from prescription painkillers and heroin. So on the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes, they're going to talk about new local, state, and federal efforts to stem that epidemic. That's coming up in in just a few minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'll let you use your devices to do this. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for us on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
This week, unexpected moments from the campaign trail.
Do you think when you're president, you'll be paid as much as if it were a man, male?
On the road with Hillary Clinton as her primary battle with Bernie Sanders intensifies.
Well, this is one of the jobs where they have to pay you the same.
And stories beyond the headlines on All Things Considered every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Join me for All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Levi Felix, the founder and CEO of Digital Detox, which is a company that helps people stop. Stop the madness. Matt Crossman is also with us. He's a freelance writer. He writes a lot of sports articles for a lot of sports publications. But he spent a month off of social media at the behest of Charlotte Magazine. And there's an article that's really interesting about his experience with that in the November issue of Charlotte Magazine, which I think you can still get online. Donovan Matthews writes, as I write this on my smartphone, the irony is not lost on me. Last year, I watched a priest texting while crossing the street. I called out to him saying that that was a true act of faith. I don't think he got it. The biggest problem I see with digital interaction is what I see in my 20-year-old age children. They don't know much or retain much information because they Google it instead. Case in point was my query about xenophobes to my son, who thought, why would anybody be afraid of Xena? She's just a TV character. Pitiful and sad, he says. Will this cause us to devolve? What do you think?
I'm not sure I buy the argument that because you can look something up easier. I frankly would think, his anecdote is funny. The amount of things that you can look up when you are looking up real things and not pictures of cats who look like Star Wars characters, that's incredible.
Yeah.
The amount of times it's usually my wife who ends up Googling it, but sometimes it's me when we'll be having a conversation with our children. I have daughters who are 9 and 6, and they will say, what does this word mean, or who is this person, or what is this, or what is that? And we use Google for that all the time, and it's an absolute – that's incredible. That's revolutionary in terms of the way we acquire information. But the number of times where you actually use it for something – beneficial like that, I would say the percentage is probably pretty low.
And I want to salute him because he said he sent that by his smartphone and there wasn't a single typo in it. I've never been able to achieve
that. That's huge. He must have small thumbs.
He must. Or a great big phone. Levi, this idea for digital detox retreats and camps, where did it come from?
So when we got back from traveling, we looked around and saw that no one knew how to slow down. Everyone was always on, and looking into traditions, into rituals, we were in Thailand and had just done a 10-day silent retreat. We said, well, let's create a retreat here for people to unplug. And that's what we did. We rented out a hot springs. We, used the internet to meet people where they were and said, come on a digital detox, disconnect to reconnect, unplug from the noisy world, and explore what's going on your internet, your inside.
And how many people came to that first session?
That first one was 12 people. There's people from Cisco and Tom's Shoes and Facebook and, the whole spectrum of technology and also non-technology jobs. And 4 days later, we thought, okay, people would just leave feeling relaxed. And people left, totally renewed. And they said, you've got to do this for my friends. You've got to do this for other people. So we just started doing them more and more, and that was in 2012.
So let's be clear. What happens at these – and you have two different things going on. You have these detox retreats, and then you have – I think you have camps where you're actually out in the wilderness or out in the woods. It's kind of like Boy Scout camp without the phones. What happens? You take away people's devices. What else?
Yes. So Camp Grounded is a summer camp for adults. That's – our main focus now, because we figured if we can take 300 to 500 people off their devices and have a shared experience, and then they go back to society, that becomes almost a movement of people now who are connected. So people show up to camp, they turn in their devices. They even fill out a form to track how much technology they use. They become more aware of that. And then they go out and they're in camp. It's literally a summer camp for adults. And we have rules in place first to make sure that people have the ground rules. So there's no digital technology, no watches. We don't want people to be concerned with the time. We want them to retune in with being able to look up at the sun and get an idea of, are they hungry? We put in a no networking rule and no work talk rule, because what's the first thing adults do when they get bored?
What do you
they
do?
Talk about what they do. What do you do?
So you're not allowed to talk about what you do. You're not allowed to talk about work. You're not allowed to network. You're not allowed to use this as an opportunity to meet people that might be beneficial to you in your business life.
Exactly. Okay. Because then people would just be networking all weekend. And so in place, we have everything from yoga to meditation to, you know, it's, people think arts and crafts is silly, but hey, woodworking. I learned how to make something out of wood. Learn how to watercolor from one of the best watercolor artists. We've got still walking. We've got improv. We've got over 50 activities, because when you unplug from your devices, it's not about what you're running away from. It's about what you want to fill your life with, because if we're looking for connection, if we're looking to learn new things and have hobbies and share experiences with other humans, why not try new things? And so even a talent show, for example, people say, if you've got a talent show, and I say, well, when was the last time you performed or told a story or played music? And people are like, well, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years. And I say, well, imagine the feeling you get on Facebook. Well, imagine taking that and multiplying it, because you're getting up in front of real people and you're playing guitar, which you've never played in your entire life, and you're playing it, you're playing a, you know, maybe just part of a song that you learned during free time, but you're playing it, and that feeling of connection to the camp community is incredible.
So you also take away their names. People can't use their real names. In fact, you have a different name in these camps. You are Fidget Wigglesworth. Why? Why do you take away people's names?
Well, first of all, we don't take them away. We invite them to give themselves a nickname. And the idea with that is, part A, you know, a lot of people come to camp, people know from back home, or they think they know. They're mutual friends they never met on Facebook. So you look at someone and they said, oh, I'm John. All of a sudden, oh, you're John, Sarah's roommate who works at Apple, who I know, you know, and you put them in a box. If they have a nickname, all of a sudden it gives you permission to talk to people you don't know. You might meet someone and say, oh, you're Don Quixote, or oh, you're Sparkle, or whatever their nickname might be. But it basically gives you permission to have conversations with total strangers, and the nickname is that conduit.
Well, here's a scary question. When you can't talk about work, when you don't have your phone, and there are going to be silences in conversations, and you can't go to your phone to fill the silence, what do people talk about?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, we give people journals also to pull out instead of their phone. We say, get bored. Give your brain a chance to just get bored, because you'd be surprised by what shows up and what new ideas you have. But we also tell people, ask people things about their life that you haven't talked about in years. So you have people sharing stories about their grandparents. You have people sharing stories, you know, about the best places they've traveled. You have people talking about things that they haven't thought about, you know, for years. And at first it's super awkward. People might not know what to talk about, and that's okay. And so instead they say, hey, do you want to go hike through the woods? Do you want to go play basketball? Do you want to go play tennis? Do you want to go for a swim in the river? And people start talking about the things that they want to do together, and they share an experience. And then later they have that experience to share. And it's amazing how quickly people can get over feeling awkward.
Do you think that that's one of the reasons that we spend so much time on our smartphones? Because it allows us not to think. It allows us not to think about things that perhaps we might find uncomfortable.
That's a great question. And yes, 100%. At Camp Grounded, people tell me, you know, I had to face some really hard stuff. I had to think about my best friend from childhood that I lost track of because I was a jerk. Or I had to think about my wife who I haven't been hanging out with enough, and I want to restructure my relationship with my children. And one example is, I had a mother this summer who sends her daughter to camp every summer. And her daughter comes home super excited and wants to tell her mom about everything. And her mom probably gives her 15 minutes and says, okay, that's enough. And this mother came to me at the end of the camp and said, now I want to go home and tell my daughter all about my camp experience. And I realized I don't really listen to her anymore. So she she went home and now is has a better relationship with her daughter because she realizes that she wants to be heard too and that she wants to be there for her daughter. And that's amazing. I mean, not to mention people often leave camp and they quit their job because they realize they don't want to be doing what they were doing because it puts them on a screen 12 hours a day. Or people go home and they make rules in their family. It's okay, no phones in the bedroom anymore, no phones behind the dining room table. And it's pretty incredible how one 4-day experience is enough to give people time to reflect.
Well, that's one of the, you just mentioned one of the things that you suggest, that you, that people do not bring their smartphones into the bedroom. A lot of people use their smartphones as alarm clocks, and you say, buy an alarm clock. What's the difference?
So if you have your phone next to your bed and your alarm goes off and you turn over, what's the first thing you do? Well, you see that you got 30 push notifications and tons of emails and messages. And so you end up in your bed connected to the entire world, and they're all in bed with you, which probably wouldn't make your mom happy. You know, theoretically. And
what kind of show is this?
You know, but I think that, and then you're not, then your first 20 minutes of your day, your first hour a day, all of a sudden it turns into the rest of your day and you've lost. Yeah. I mean, you've lost all that time and connection. And when you have an alarm clock, you reach over and you turn it off, and then it's just you or you and the person you're with. And instead of reaching for your phone, you reach for your partner at night, which is an amazing thing. I mean, 90% of people now sleep with their phone next to their bed, and people are checking their phones in the middle of the night. And that totally screws up your circadian rhythm, which causes you to release less melatonin, which causes you to get less sleep, which makes you a crankier, more irritable.
Yeah, and they say that exposure to the light color that comes out of the phone screens, that kind of blue light, is not good for your brain, and it wakes you up. So it's kind of a new kind. It's a new way of defining the so-called blue screen of death.
Yeah, and also, I think, just why do you need to be looking at that at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
You know, what? How have we gotten to the point where we think it's important to check email at 3 o'clock in the morning? I was at a Bible study with some men the other day talking about, they will write an email at 3 o'clock in the morning and not send it until 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. So that the person to whom they are sending it will not know that they were up at 3 o'clock in the morning sending an email. And I'm like, my gosh, that is a lot of sort of ethical gymnastics you're getting to hide the fact that you're on your phone at 3 o'clock in the morning.
So from your experience, you were off this for a month. Did it change you when you finished this assignment for Charlotte Magazine and you went back to the real world and you have your smartphone and your computer? Did it change your behavior, your interaction with the frequency, the amount of time that you devote to this?
I would say I'm working on it. I discovered I don't follow – if you look at my Twitter feed, it says that I follow three people, but they are all blocked. It's basically my best friend who covers the Detroit Tigers. He's got a side business where he tweets for a couple of places, so I followed them so he would have more followers, and then I muted him. So I don't follow anybody. I check it much less.
Why not just get rid of your account? Get rid of the app. Take it off the phone.
I don't have it on my phone. And honestly, the only reason that I'm still on Twitter is I feel like, as a writer in the journalism world, if I'm going to continue to have a business, I need to have a Twitter.
Let's talk about that for just a second.
And that might be BS, but that's the only reason.
Some employers, particularly in the media, are now telling their reporters and others to tweet. Tweet about the stories they're covering. Tweet about what else is going on in the publication or on the air. And we're being judged. Employees are being judged by how many people are following them.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
There's a lot of different ways to answer that question. Let's take my friend who covers the Detroit Tigers. It's unquestionable. It's part of his job. He has to be on Twitter because that's the way the journalism world works these days. His employer pays him to cover the Tigers. And so to tweet about the Tigers is fundamentally part of his job. It's less so with me, but certainly publications for whom I write or who might want me to write for them, they're going to check my Twitter feed. I know of one who pays writers a sliding scale based on how many Twitter followers they have. Now, that's their prerogative. I think that's ridiculous, but because you could buy fake Twitter followers if you want. But it's unquestionably part of the journalism world, and there's no unmaking it part of the journalism world.
So from your experience of conducting these camps and retreats, Felix, with people who come to you fully connected and realize that they're completely disconnected from their real world, what's the best way to do this? Is the best way to digitally detox to set aside a weekend or a day of the week and simply turn off everything, or to simply slowly check less frequently, turn off the notification sounders on your phone, etc.? How should people approach this the most effective way?
Good question. I think the first thing to point out is that we're all trying to figure that out. Step one, I suggest people take an extended period of time off, you know, even 4 days, 5 days. It takes about that long for blood pressure and heart rate to go down and for one to really feel a starting of the separation. And then on the return, I think introducing different parts of your day that are device-free. So start with the bedroom. If someone just started 1 week with no phones in their bedroom and using an alarm clock, that's a great step. If they then introduce, okay, lunch and dinner are going to be screen-free, that's another great step. If someone says, okay, no phones in the bathroom and no phones while I'm moving faster than 4 miles per hour, i.e. in a car or bike riding or walking quickly, that's another great step. And if you start introducing these small things, even wearing a watch, if you wear a watch, when you want to know what time it is, you don't look in your pocket, you look at your watch. But if you pull out your phone, then you're instantly looking, you're sucked into the world of technology. So there's all these different quote-unquote, you know, life hacks you could make, which would keep you off your device more.
And don't buy a smartwatch. Don't buy an Apple Watch. Is that what you're also telling us?
I mean, I suggest an analog watch. Okay. You know, I have a friend who has a company now that it's making high-end jewelry, and the idea is that if your ring vibrates, then you know it's an important thing. And I think, you know, we're looking for solutions. I think the big thing I've noticed in language on this call is about blame, or is about feeling silly or stupid or pathetic. And to be honest, I don't come from that approach, because what we should be doing is looking at the people who are creating these technologies, because on their walls of their boardrooms, they've got the word dopamine.
And let me stop you there, because we're completely out of time. Levi Felix, founder and CEO of Digital Detox. Matt Crossman, freelance writer. His article, My Month Off Social Media, is in the November issue of Charlotte Magazine. Charlotte Talk.